rather than line-by-line discussions about particular sort support items. The ability to step back and really try to understand with the participant and family the support needs that the participant needs to live a fantastic life. We need to be able to make sure we give a great level of flexibility for people to get on and spend their NDIS supports how they want to over a longer plan duration.
You know, even the word assessment can be difficult for people. You know, like it brings up memories of assessments where the experience has been really poor. We want the experience that people go through to be positive.
Many different communities are probably very well aware, concerned that these assessments are going to be used to cut people's plans. What would you say to people who are concerned about this as a cost-cutting measure?
Hi, I'm Dr. George Thomas, and welcome to Visual and Necessary, Australia's premier podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri land and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, make sure you subscribe to the channel and select the notification bell so you can be notified of future episodes. In today's episode, we delve deep into the biggest changes ever to NDIS support needs assessments. We will uncover what the new assessment will look like, who will be doing the assessing, and how it will shape our NDIS budgets. Check it out. Hey, Aaron and Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi, George.
Hi, George.
So good to have you on. Can we start with some introductions? Can I start with you, Aaron?
Yeah, hi, George. Hi, everyone. Aaron Villain here. I'm the Acting Deputy CEO of the Service Design and Improvement Group within the NDIA. Great to be here.
Jason.
Hi, George, and hi to all your listeners. My name's Jason Thompson. I'm Professor of Mental Health Systems Reform at the University of Melbourne, and I'm leading this project alongside the Centre for Disability Studies, who are also involved in the project that we're going to be talking about today.
Great. So you're from the University of Melbourne. I understand that the University of Sydney actually developed the ICANN, which we're going to be talking about. Can you tell us a bit about how the consortium's going to work?
Yep. So it is a consortium, and it's not strictly the University of Sydney. It's University of Melbourne alongside the Centre for Disability Studies. This is really, you know, an exciting team. I think we've got the University of Melbourne as number one research institute in Australia. We've got Centre for Disability Studies, which brings its deep understanding of disability research. It's got its background developing the ICANN tool.
Awesome. We're going to talk a lot more about the ICANN today, which is something that everyone in the sector is talking about. Today, the focus is on support needs assessments, and this is part of some really big changes that are coming our way in the NDIS, and big changes in how NDIS plans and budgets are going to be developed. And I understand that we're calling this new framework planning. So I want to start with new framework planning. Aaron, what is this new approach to planning, and what changes will this mean for NDIS assessments?
Yeah, thanks, George. It is exactly that. It is a new way in which we will be undertaking planning with participants. This has been as a result of the recent changes with the legislation back in October 2024, but also as an outcome of the NDIS review. And really importantly, new framework planning is about creating more flexible plans, and really having a new support needs assessment that will inform a total budget. Now, there's a whole lot of new terms in that, which I know we're going to unpack in this discussion. But what I do really want to emphasise, it is a new way of planning, and it really puts greater flexibility in participants' plans. But it also allows the opportunity to do a new assessment to really understand the support needs of the participants. So I'm looking forward to spending the time talking through those particular parts.
Greater flexibility, I'm all for that. How will plans be more flexible, Aaron?
Yeah, so under the construct of the new plan, there will be a flexible component and then there will be stated supports. We've heard constantly from participants about the challenges around line-by-line items that can be really restrictive in what participants can and can't spend their funding on. We want to remove that layer of line-by-line items and really create an opportunity for a core flexible budget that individuals will be able to have choice on how they spend that funding in accordance with NDIS supports. Of course, there will be some stated items, and those stated items, for example, are assistive technology, home modifications, for example, and it's really important that they are stated supports so that we can clearly secure a level of funding for those really important items. But that has to be the exception and not the rule. And so we need to make sure we get out there and really communicate about just the level of flexibility that participants will have under new framework planning.
So currently we have full budget and capacity building budget. Are people going to be able to spend across those two categories? So it won't matter.
It'll be the one core flexible budget. There will be some line items within those flexible components, like therapy. Therapy is a really great example where it'll be a single line that will say therapy. And what it really does is allow an opportunity to be able to expend the money flexibly. So there is no core and capacity under the new construct. It is the one flexible budget, as I said, along with some stated support items.
Okay, and central to the new framework is this support needs assessment, which we're going to dive deep into, and it's really good to have you here, Jason. You have a lot of knowledge and expertise about support needs assessment. So help people understand how this actual assessment will work in practice. Can you, Jason, please explain what this ICANN tool is, what does it look at, and how does it work in terms of assessing people's actual real-life support needs?
Thanks for the question, George. So one of the things that we want to emphasize here is this is an assessment tool that is not a cookie cutter approach. It's very much about understanding people's entire lives and the sorts of supports that they will require across a range of domains and that will help them achieve the things that they want for their life. So, not to get too nerdy about it, I did a quick calculation this morning and even at most basic level, the combinations of things that of support needs that you can of the assessment sort of profiles that you can produce from the ICANN across the domain, so mobility, domestic life, self-care, community and civic life, communication, learning and applying knowledge. There's 12 different domains, and there are vastly more sort of combinations of supports that can be produced from the support needs assessment than there even are participants in the scheme itself. So we want to emphasize that this is a structured way of assessing need flexibly. So it's this combination of structure, emphasizing fairness, transparency of the assessment, but doing it assessing need across all of these 12 domains, at least 12 domains, But do it in a, in so it appreciates the individual nature of people's lives and the unique circumstances that people might be in. So we would describe this as a person-centered and strength-based assessment process, which we're assisting to implement. And by that, we mean it's about the person, it's about the environment that they're in, it's about their goals and aspirations. So it's the interaction of all these things coming together. But again, it's doing it in a fairly structured or a semi-structured kind of way that allows people's individual characteristics and needs to be able to be appropriately, accurately, validly, reliably assessed. This is the beginning of a 5-year program. So we are coming from an exceptionally strong base. The ICANN has all of the research associated with it is in the public domain. One of the strengths that we think we bring in this partnership is the work with the agency, work with the community around the quality assurance of this as it's rolled out, work with people around understanding from disability groups, from people with disabilities, looking at it from both a qualitative and quantitative perspective. How is this going so that we know that it is accurate, appropriate, suitable for use to achieve all the things that people want in their lives, and also that it's useful for the NDIA as well. So it's all of these things coming together.
It's really interesting. I think a lot of people with disability have, you know, in our lives have been part of all sorts of different assessments. So, you know, disability because of whether it be Centrelink or other diagnostic reasons. Yeah. Can you get a feel for what a question might look like? Like, what might you ask me as a person in this situation?
Well, I suppose I want to go back to the point you know, just before I go into that, the point you raised about assessment itself, and you talked about multiple assessments. You know, even the word assessment can be difficult for people. You know, like it brings up memories of assessments where the experience has been really poor. So that is also absolutely a criteria that we are looking at in the monitoring and the quality evaluation of this process, that we want the experience that people go through to be positive and as positive as possible. So we don't want it to be anxiety producing. We know we absolutely understand that people feel like there is a lot at stake for people in these types of conversations. So we want to make sure that it is a conversation about needs. It's about, you know, goals and aspirations. It's about your daily life. So the questions would be very natural. It's a conversational sort of style where it's prompted through the sorts of domains. So asking people about their daily life, what it is that they like to achieve, how it is that they like to go about their lives. So it's very conversational, and that's the way it should come across. And it's just a way of collecting data and collecting information from people that can then be interpreted to fairly and accurately quantify support needs for people.
Aaron, why was the ICANN chosen? I know that there was a procurement process where you would have had, you know, a range of tools that were presented to you. Why did you choose the ICANN?
Yeah, thanks, George. As you said, there was a bit of literature already on the support needs assessment. Whether or not that was through the NDIS review or some of the other findings, and what we did initially was work with the disability community about what are the most important things to you when understanding your support needs. As you said, that informed a bit of a statement of requirements or when we went out to undertake the procurement, we wanted to understand what are the key requirements that we wanted to have a look at. We also wanted to really focus in on tools that were readily available and backed by academic research. As Jason said, and as many people know, what we didn't want to do is have the agency go away and design it themselves. We wanted to leverage off existing research. And then that's what led to the decision around the ICANN. As Jason said, we recognise there isn't a single tool available that meets all the needs and requirements and understanding of the support needs of participants. But we were pretty confident around the basis of the ICANN version 6 that is a really great validated tool that we can continue to work through, which will ultimately inform an NDIS support needs assessment process. And so that's how we came to the decision around procuring the ICANN with the University of Melbourne and Centre for Disability Studies.
And can I just, do you mind if I jump in there too, George? You know, I just want to emphasise too that the ICANN, you know, has a great provenance. It's almost the descendant, if you like, of the ICF framework, so International Classification of Functioning, which comes from the World Health Organization. So it was its original development was really about understanding people, not from a diagnostic perspective, but what supports across your life do you need in order to live a full and fulfilling life. So its history and its philosophy, if you like, is very much about this sort of holistic understanding of people and their lives.
I'd like to hear a bit more about that history. And also about how effective and, you know, reliable the ICANN is. Has it been used in lots of different ways? And what do we know about how effective it is and how reliable it is? And I'm asking this because it's going to be really important that you get it right and that the result is accurate.
We do have the published in the public domain literature around the ICANN, remembering that this is the baseline, the starting point for which we're converting that into the support needs assessment for the NDIA. So this, there is that history. It's been used across lots of different disability types. The reliability and validity has been demonstrated to be, you know, great in relation to agreeing with other expert opinion and sort of face validity and so there's all of that is in the public domain. So we can rest assured that we're starting from this really strong base. So our job is to work with the NDIA to work with the community to craft that and bring the best principles of the ICANN into the SNA and to monitor that over time to make sure that people are happy with the process, that how it happens, that it's accurately assessing support needs across those domains, that it's reliable. So, you know, if you have the same person getting tested or being assessed sort of multiple times, you know, you get the same result. If you have two different people assessing someone, they get the same result as well. So we'll be doing all that sort of research stuff in the background, also qualitative research, lots of interviews with people who have been through the process, assessors themselves, looking at the workforce, all these sorts of things to do this quality assurance over the next few years.
That's really interesting. And so what I'm picking up there is the support needs assessment will be more than just the ICANN. Is that right? Do you want to say more about that? Because I don't think that's widely understood.
Did you want me to jump in then? I'm happy to provide, because I think it's a really good point, particularly around understanding, well, what ultimately is the support needs assessment that will inform the budget? And you're right, there are a couple of components. And so the basis is the ICANN, as Jason has outlined. There are two other really important parts that will inform the final support needs assessment report. The first one is the personal and environmental circumstances questionnaire. And I know many people understand and have heard of the PEC. We've been doing a bit of work about refining that with the broader disability community, because what that does is then really start to focus in on the individual. Where does the individual live? Where is the location? What level of informal supports? How does that operate within their everyday life? And so there is a real connection between the broad assessment of support needs and then the individual circumstances, and particularly, as I said, the location of where the participant resides. And then the third part, which I know we'll talk about a little bit later on, is what we are calling a couple of targeted assessments. And those targeted assessments where it is, for example, assistive technology or high-cost home modifications, or particularly in some of our disability-related health supports, where there may be some requirements for some quite specific questions about understanding those particular parts. And so it's taking all of those parts, the basis of the ICANN, the personal and environment circumstances questionnaire, and then where appropriate, particular targeted assessments, as I've outlined. How do you bring those together that will ultimately inform the support needs assessment report? And we've had a lot of questions, and we want to spend a lot of time working with the community about the construct of the support needs assessment, going beyond the ICANN and really focusing in on that support needs assessment report, and importantly, how that would then inform a total budget. And I know we can talk a little bit about that later on, but I'm glad you asked the question, George, because I think too often everyone's just focused in on ICANN, and what we need to do is lift it and go beyond to go, we really want to focus in on the support needs assessment report and what that looks like and how that informs the budget. So thanks for asking it.
Yeah, and thanks for the answer. It's important that people know what's coming. And I'd like to focus now on who's going to conduct the assessment. There's a lot of interest in who's going to carry them out. Can you tell us, Aaron, who will the assessors be, and what kind of background and experience will they need? And how will the interact, make sure that they're fit for the job?
Yeah, thanks, George. As I said, it's another one of these myth-busting things we need to make sure we get right and let the broader community understand about who is the assessor. So the first part of that question is there will be a number of assessors, so trained workforce within the agency that have allied health professions. And the core reason why we are starting with that is to make sure we work with the University of Melbourne and the Centre for Disability Studies to have an accredited workforce that can apply the core components of the ICANN appropriately and that it is validated. And it's really important to have that core group of assessors with allied health qualifications to maintain the integrity of the support needs assessment, particularly not just over the 4 or 5 years that we are working with University of Melbourne, but going beyond as an enduring capability with the agency to have that core accreditation. The second part of that is what we are doing is we're working with the University of Melbourne and the Centre for Disability Studies about what is an appropriate training package that we can utilise for then our other assessors to be able to administer the support needs assessment report. And so what we've been really clear is, as part of that broad training, they won't require the core allied health profession. And so what we are doing is, as I said, we're working with the consortium really about designing a training package to be able to do that. Now, within the agency, we already have a large number of staff that have a varying number of qualifications and clearly have been working with participants for a number of years. And so we will be drawing a lot from our agency staff. we know we also need to do some external recruitment just because of the sheer number of individuals we'll need, particularly as we talk about things like transition, George, where we're still going to have people on the current planning and also on the new planning. But I really want to come back to your question, which is there is a core number of staff within the agency that will be assessors with allied health professions.
And Sharon, Jason, how do you feel about the fact that it sounds like we're going to start with these allied health professionals, but as the assessors expand and we get more, that we will have a lot of people who aren't allied health professionals? Is that a risk, do you think, or...?
If we go back to even the ICANN itself, and, you know, we're talking about the SNA, but in that the ICANN itself recommends that, you know, people are allied health professionals and or have relevant experience. So there's lots of people, I'm sure, even, you know, perhaps listening to this podcast, who have relevant lived experience, who might have the skills to be able to do, you know, these sorts of things. So our role is really to keep, you know, to help the NDIA keep an eye on the rollout and sort of say, okay, it needs tweaks here, training needs to be updated there, maybe for this group it's not working so much, all that sort of thing. So for us, it's you know, how do we feel about it? It's not so much a feeling, but this is something that we will absolutely be monitoring and providing that feedback to the NDIA. And we're actually, you know, one of the things that we're very pleased about in our consortium is that we have this, you know, open dialogue, if you like, between the NDIA and ourselves about all of these sorts of issues, because, you know, there are always going to be system constraints. You have to think about how things are rolled out, but the important thing is to gather the evidence to make sure that that we maintain, as we sort of said earlier, the integrity of the SNA, the principles of the SNA, that people are having a good experience, that it's accurate, it's reliable, it's measuring what it's supposed to be measuring, you know, as it's rolled out in the way it is rolled out. And so our job is to be there to help that.
And you're doing a lot of the training, or you're helping to set that up, is that right, Jason?
Yeah, so the Centre for Disability Studies is setting up most of the training. The initial sort of training is nominally called sort of Workstream 2. So they're really sort of looking after the training. So I'm a researcher. I'm not really a trainer, I would say. So but that's absolutely their expertise, and that's where they're coming into their own.
And what kind of training do you think they'll need, or is it too early for?
Well, there's the existing ICANN training, and one of the things about the existing ICANN training is that it's as much about the principles of this sort of semi-structured conversational data gathering exercise, which is so important. And, you know, we're pretty confident that the skills that people learn in that whole in that package, they should absolutely be transferable to the SNA when it is formed.
What do we know already about the training in terms of how long it takes? Do we know if these, you know, people who are going to be doing the assessments, are they going to have to have experience working with people who might be nonverbal, or they might have communication needs or complex needs? These are things where it can be really hard for a person who's never met the person that they're about to assess to actually find out what the support needs really are.
Yeah, it's a great question, George. There's a couple of things. So, you know, we've got a great workforce already that are interacting day in day with participants with varying communication needs and requirements in the way in which we're doing planning today. And so that's a great starting point for us. The second thing, which is really important, is we need to spend some time over coming months working with the community and doing some what we're calling a bit of a design hub, where we're bringing participants in, we're having the opportunity to do some trialing and really stopping and pausing and taking the opportunity to learn from the utiliser of the support needs assessment process. So I think it's really important that along the journey, we're having the opportunity to work with a variety of participants and a whole lot of different cohorts to really start learning around the experience. So that they're the two parts. We want to be able to have a whole lot of training, particularly around disability, around trauma-informed discussion. We know we've got to continue to work through, particularly with our First Nations and our core communities. And then, as you said, with participants with a whole range of different communication and information needs and requirements. And that's the work that we've got to do now. Now that we've got the tool, now that we've got the process, we've really got to roll up our sleeves and start working through that. It's great. Even just this week, we've kicked off some early work. We had some participants come into the agency and really start to commence those discussions and really get live feedback around the experience. And it's really now about the experience to ensure that we can maximise the opportunity to understand a participant's support needs.
Currently, participants come to a planning meeting with lots of reports and our own health views on what the person needs. In the new approach, will there be consideration of these existing reports so that the assessor can have a more detailed understanding of what that person needs?
Yeah, I might jump in there, George. Again, it's great, a great question to really provide some clarity around this language around evidence. The starting position, and this really stems back also to the NDIS review, was around just levels of inequity about those that could afford reports and those individuals that couldn't, and were we then having a fair and consistent outcome? And so our starting position with the support needs assessment is that we do not require evidence to understand your broad support needs. And so I think we've got to get that message out so that, you know, what we've heard and you will have well have heard, George, is just how expensive and time consuming that it takes to receive our reports. We want to remove that kind of stress. The question is about the support needs assessor. Of course, for an existing participant, they would be looking at the information that is already available on the participant as part of their preparation work to understand the participant. But as they go into the actual support needs assessment, and as Jason outlined about the broad structure, it's a conversation and it's informing some outcomes of support needs. We really don't want individuals feeling like they need to bring a whole lot of new reports to that. Where there might be a requirement to bring reports and evidence, as I said, is more in those targeted assessments. It's more in those high-cost assistive technology. It's more in behaviour supports, home modifications, those kind of aspects. What we do need to do is be really clear about when and when do you not need to bring information or evidence, and what is the type of evidence that you need to provide. We're going to be really open and transparent around that. And as I said, in most cases, existing participants already have that. It's really about our ability to draw upon that information. But my starting point is you do not need to go and source new evidence, new information. We've got to make sure, as part of these reforms, one of the key principles is about equity and about the ability for any participant to be able to have their support needs assessed without the requirement of those costly and time-consuming reports.
I want to dive now into the actual experience of the participant. What will the assessment process look like, Aaron? How long will it take? Where will it happen? And, you know, what will the people experience once they meet up with their assessor?
there are varying time durations of planning meetings today, depending on participants. Some participants are quite short in their planning discussions, and others take a long period of time. Whether or not that's the complexity of their disability, or the duration, or those particular types of communication requirements. And so it's very difficult to say, you know, for everyone, it's going to be a couple of hours. What we're trying to do through the testing phase is really trying to understand what is an appropriate amount of time to capture the information around that. So that's my starting point. The second one, George, is our real preference for the support needs assessment is face-to-face. Now, before, and face-to-face can occur in different ways. Clearly, it can be physical face-to-face, actual in a room together, whether or not that's at an NDIA office or at another location, or it can be like this, like we're having a conversation today. We know we've got to provide some information over coming months, particularly around some better information around the likely time. We're just getting a real sense, and we'll probably get a better sense as soon as we continue to start having some experience directly with participants around what that looks like. But what we don't want, really importantly, is a long, protracted process on both sides. We've got to make sure it's comfortable and appropriate for the participant as well about that. The big thing for us is really the emphasis on preparing the participant for the ACT support needs assessment. I think if participants can come into the meeting, into the assessment process, understanding what it looks like, understanding how long it takes, understanding to your question before, George, about how does it work? Are they set questions or is it a conversation? We've got to do really well in really supporting our participants before the meeting, because I suspect that will really help then the conduct of the assessment around that. So I hope that answers your question.
I'm happy to jump in there a little bit too, you know, and I'm speaking generally here. The answer to how long, et cetera, is generally as long as it needs to be and to be adequate and appropriate for people to do what needs to be done. Certainly not, you know, certainly not, you know, 12 months also, but you know, as Aaron sort of described, yeah, we might be talking sort of 3 to 4 hours as a general rule to begin with.
Oh, so we're going to have to take a day off work.
And when I say 3 or 4 hours, you know, don't take that as gospel. This is, you know, like if it was a fairly in-depth kind of conversation.
Yeah,
for different people, it will be different.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that, you know, for me, for example, I'd probably need a break in that time. So
yeah.
Is that going to be accommodative with your mentor that people can do that?
Of course. So,
and if there are issues around, you know, those time frames or anything, that will also come out in the feedback that we get. So, you know, adaptations might be made at that point.
Aaron, when the assessment is completed, what happens next?
Yeah, and so following the outcome of the assessment, there is a support needs assessment report that is then submitted from the assessor to a delegate, and there is a clear separation between those two decision points. What the delegate will then do is the delegate then reviews the assessment report and ultimately makes the first decision about whether or not it's a valid report. And as Jason said, we're really starting to define what's the quality assurance program and process around a valid support needs assessment report. Again, really importantly, the delegate cannot go in and start changing particular parts of the report. They have a simple question, which is it a valid overall assessment or do I need to seek a new assessment? And so, again, I really want to reassure particularly the viewers on the podcast that delegates do not, under the new structure, go in and start, I don't like that particular answer or I want to continue. It's really that first choice. What happens then is that will then inform the total budget. And this is new, again, a new piece of the legislation which removes from the line-by-line budget items to an overall total budget that will be a flexible and stated component. Now, what we do need to do as part of the legislation is be really open and transparent about how the support needs assessment will derive a budget. And so, again, we're going to be working with the broader community about how we outline how that occurs. What then happens is the delegate will then have a discussion with the participant about the report, the new plan, how the funding has been derived, and then really importantly, a couple of delegate decisions that they will work with the participant on, and that is the length of the plan, funding periods, and then of course make decisions collectively around things like plan management type. Is it self-managed, agency managed, or plan managed, similar today? And that is the discussion between the delegate and the participant. And what we want to be able to do is we'll provide a whole lot of information on our website and send it out to our sector and our community, which really outlines and explains that process, George.
So will the participant get a copy of their assessment result?
Yeah, they will get a copy of their assessment report. What it looks like, we're still working through clearly, and we want to be able to spend the time, particularly if we are having components like parts of the ICAN, we've got the personal environment circumstances and then targeted modules. What does that ultimate report look like? And how is that different then to your plan? And so we're going to be working with participants around the structure of both of those documents, but participants will get a copy of their support needs assessment report.
And what if they see a mistake in the report? So say the report says, oh, I can, you know, shower myself, and I can't shower myself.
Yeah, so the support needs assessment report is a reviewable item. And so certainly it is important that we explain that a participant can seek a new support needs assessment. So let's spend a little bit more time making sure we communicate that around that. They cannot make individual changes to particular parts of the report. The reviewable decision, as I said at the start, is that a valid overall support needs assessment, or am I seeking a review to have a new support needs assessment? So again, we just need to make sure we get that language right.
So will the agency then decide yes or no if you get another assessment? Is that how it works?
It's a reviewable decision, and so the same reviewable decisions requirements would apply.
Right, so then you can go through the appeals process to the Administrative Review Tribunal.
Yep. But as I said, George, it's not on a particular element. It's whether or not to seek a brand new support needs assessment.
Thanks, Aaron. Many people in the community, as you're probably very well aware, concerned that these assessments are going to be used to cut people's plans. What would you say to people who are concerned about this as a cost-cutting measure?
Yeah, it's really important. That's why we've separated the two particular roles. The assessor is there to undertake a holistic support needs assessment with the individual. They are not there talking about line-by-line items and budgets and how many hours I need of particular support. They are undertaking a support needs assessment, and then they are providing it to the delegate. That's the first important point, which is why there's separation and not discussions about sustainability or actual prices of supports. The second really important part is the delegate is not going in and then making changes to the assessment report. And so with those two distinct moments, therefore, it isn't a cost-cutting exercise of the agency, because we're clearly separating the particular roles. And I just want to reassure it, the assessor is undertaking the assessment around the support needs of the individual.
But in terms of turning the assess a result and someone bans it, that there'll be a process where clearly a certain dollar amount will be allocated based on a certain assessment result. I think people are concerned with that process. Will it be transparent? Will we understand how that turned into that funding allocation?
Absolutely. Yep. It is a requirement under the legislation to provide the transparency and understand how the assessment informs the budget. So certainly, and not just transparent from a government perspective. As you know, George, too often we write in government speak. It has to be absolutely something that participants and the community can understand.
That's going to be so important. Looking ahead, when will the year first commence, and give me the first experience, or be a staged approach?
Yeah, absolutely, it'll be a staged approach. Certainly, there is no intention for the existing 750,000 participants to all start on day one. Simply, the agency would never have the ability to be able to do that. And so we've been pretty open around commencing new framework planning from mid-2026. And absolutely, it will be a staged rollout of new framework planning. As Jason said, you know, we have about 4.5 to 5 year transition process. But your absolute question about who goes first, we know over coming months we need to provide really clear information around locations and also who's going to be the first to roll out. There are a couple of indications already. I think we've been really clear that we are the tool, particularly the ICANN, initially is from 16 plus. And so there is no intention that children younger than 16, 17 would be part of the first rollout. So I want to be really clear about that. It is likely also to be less complexity of participants also, because as I've said, you know, we want to really make sure we're getting this right. So again, I'm really happy over coming months to provide some really clear information about what we're calling our transition strategy, particularly of our existing participants.
So we're going to be like a pilot phase to just check that it's safe and working effectively.
So we're spending a lot of time between now and mid next year doing exactly that. There's a couple of stages to that. The first one is we're doing some desktop reviews. And so what a desktop review is really, to your point before, looking at some de-identified existing participants' information and starting to have some of our assessors starting to undertake assessment activities to really start to learn those particular bits. That's the first component, and we're going to do about 9,000 of those around those kind of assessments. Again, if you remove the children younger than 16, 17, all of a sudden 9,000 is quite a good sample size. We know that's only the first step. The next step is then to do some support needs assessments with participants, to your point, to really be able to understand the experience, the length of time, the type of discussion that is actually occurring. We've got a lot of volunteers in the agency through our participant reference group and some of our broader networks that we really want to bring in. As I said, we're calling it our design hub, is really that opportunity to stop, pause, and really have an opportunity for live feedback around that. We're going to be doing that right up until mid next year.
And Jason, you'll be involved. Will be involved in part of the evaluation. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the work that Aaron's just spelled out then about, you know, the sort of initial trialing of the SNA, we'll absolutely be involved in that. So as I sort of said before, we're coming from a really strong base with an existing tool. We're sort of crafting that to be set up for the NDIA's SNA, but of course we don't want to just plonk it in. You know, we want to you know, sort of have a look at it, see how people feel about it, see what people's experience is like with it. It's not just an off-the-shelf kind of plug-in kind of process. It's a, you know, it's a genuine, again, conversation with the community about, okay, how is this working for people?
I think it's something really important that that work is available and publicly so we can all feel confident that it's delivering what we need.
And one of the, you know, one of the things we're really pleased about with our partnership with the NDIA is this transparency of the information. So, it's all positive.
I think we've covered a lot of ground. Now I feel like I've learned a lot in this conversation. Thank you for all of your insights. Before we go, do you have any final words for participants and families about these changes and what they mean for our NDIS? And I might start with you, Jason.
I want to emphasize to people that the team that we've got, the range of people we've got, the consortium, the partnership that we have with the NDIA, we're really pleased about the principles of this. And I would really, you know, we've got a great group of people, committed people with their experience, expertise, know-how, who are really, you know, we really want to go on this journey. We're not just sort of here, as I said, to plonk something in and walk away. This is an iterative process, and I think that people should feel confident that they can have trust in the process, because this is what we're here to do. We've many of us have spent our working lives doing this kind of work, and all with the best of intentions. So I just want to give people that confidence, if you like, that this is a process that everyone is very committed to.
Thanks, Jason. Aaron?
Yeah, it's really important to remind everyone about why are we doing this? Why are we doing new framework planning? I think too often we get caught into the detail about a particular part of it. For me, there's some really important parts about why we're doing new framework planning. The first one is around creating equity and consistency and fairness in the scheme. And we know for a number of years, we just haven't had that level of equity, consistency and fairness in the scheme. The second thing for me is really around this new way of really trying to understand the support needs of an individual in a holistic way. Again, rather than line by line discussions about particular sort support items, the ability to step back and really try to understand with the participant and family the support needs that the participant needs to live a fantastic life. And then lastly is really this new level of flexibility within the budget and the plan. We need to move away from, as you said, George, about can I spend it on this particular part and can I use some funding over here? We need to be able to make sure we give a great level of flexibility for people to get on and spend their NDIS supports how they want to over a longer plan duration. And I think at times we've just got to keep reminding people about why we are moving towards new framework planning.
Thank you, Aaron. I think that there's going to be a lot more to discuss in the new year as things develop. And I think that the launch date for this new framework planning approaches is July 2026. So we hope to have you back. And before then, so we have an update. How does that sound?
Of course, George. Sounds great.
Thank you. You've both been very, very helpful. Thank you for the conversation. And I hope that we can continue to help people to understand what this means to them into the future. Thanks for your time.
Really appreciate it, George. And Aaron, thank you.
Thank you, and thanks, everyone.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Visible and Necessary. As you know, we love your feedback, so please Share your thoughts or questions in the comments section below. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.